and had many openings it could crawl through to find the food. Two Legs tasted good, and little Two Legs couldn't even fight or run away. They merely made loud noises, especially when eaten. It liked the death music they made, but the little food always became quiet after only a few bites. Big food lasted much longer, sometimes making death music for a day. Much fun. The mere thought of fresh blood flowing down its throat made the mutie shuffle faster through the roiling clouds. Descending the sloped hillside, its scaled legs sank into the softened soil, going to its knees, sometimes going all the way to its hips. At one point, the world disappeared as it sank below the churning material. But soon its claws found hard soil, and the creature dug back into the storm, where it was warm and safe. Circling around a large boulder, something crunched under its foot, and the mutie dived upon the ground, hoping it was a fresh bone. But the broken thing was only the skull of a norm. A colony of worms writhed inside, the gray meat of the brain all gone. Annoyed, the mutie threw the skull away. It knew better than to try to eat the little worms. Even if chewed into pieces, they didn't die, and would eat their way out of a belly. That was a bad thing, because then nobody else could eat the body of the fresh dead, or else the little worms might also consume them. Thunder ruled the sky, rogs ruled under the dirt, and the tiny worms ruled the dead. The mutie paused as the word strangely resonated in its twisted mind. Born of distant human ancestry, the rad-blasted being felt questions about the odd life form start to form in the back of its lopsided head, but they faded before becoming fully formed. The shriveled lumps of its frontal lobes and anterior pons were utterly incapable of processing the simple data of a direct question. Dropping to its hands and feet, the mutie started galloping toward the Wrongstone place. It could vaguely smell the Two Legs and the fresh blood. There had to be much food to make such a strong smell, maybe even more than fingers and toes combined. What a feast! Then the monstrosity recoiled as another odor was detected by its single quivering nostril. Bad water. The stinky blood of metal things that moved. Two Legs were always near bad water. It made you sick many suns if drunk. But they guarded bad water like kin. Maybe they worshipped it? Bad water also meant boomsticks. When a boomstick spoke, the mutie would feel pain as its body jerked and blood began to flow from a tiny mouth that hadn't been there before. It couldn't understand how the noise could do this, but the boomsticks hurt very bad. They were to be avoided whenever possible. Thankfully, the boomsticks were the only defense of the Two Legs. The food couldn't see well in the dark, and barely heard anything. Grabbed from behind, the Two Legs could only sing, as the mutie ate the meat and drank the warm blood. Two Legs were easy to kill. The mutie smacked oversized lips, remembering when it had once gotten a small Two Legs from the belly of its mother. The flesh was even more tender than a rotting corpse. Hopefully, there would be many of the wiggly Two Legs, and it could take a couple back to the hive and trade them to the females for a chance to climb on top of them and thrust between their legs. That was the best of all things. Clambering down a short embankment, the mutie sloshed through a sluggish creek, the mud almost thick enough to walk on. Reaching the other side, it crawled up the bank and started slithering along the ground toward the Wrongstones. It could clearly see a huge gap in the stones, the opening filled with shiny sharps and the thin humming vines that killed when touched. Ducking behind the burned wreckage of a wag, the mutie burrowed into the ash and started to wriggle toward the waiting food. The smell of the blood nearly drove it mad, and it moaned in hunger, the guttural noise sounding almost exactly like the howling wind. Four mummies of cloth stood huddled before the wide gap in the stone block wall that surrounded the Tennesseeville. Oily rags were wrapped around their long blasters in an effort to keep out the wind-blown ash. The rags helped, but using the Kalashnikovs made them jam almost immediately. The ash got inside the breech mechanism through the barrel. Some sort of ribbed plastic covered the vented ends of the blasters, but after the first shot, that meager protection disintegrated from the muzzle blast. The sec men knew they could get off only one or two rounds before the fancy rapid fires would become totally useless. Sergeant Tucholka had suggested tying knives to the ends of the rifle barrels, but the guards refused. A knife on the end of a stick was what farmers carried as weapons, not sec men. Besides, if anybody got that close, they just used the knives properly, a quick thrust into the belly, a slice across the throat, and loot the body before anybody else arrived. Even masked by the storm, the base was a tiny oasis of green grass in the middle of a hellish vista. The wall encircling the ville held off the worst of the wind, but the ash peppered the buildings with brutal force, shoving Sekhmen along the ground. The Blues Walking Patrol tied themselves to posts driven into the ground to keep from tumbling away. With their faces wrapped in multiple layers of cloth for protection, the Sekhmen could breathe in the thick air, but no sounds or words would carry beyond a few feet, with visibility stopping at a few yards. If the orange clouds above flashed with lightning or rumbled with thunder, they had no idea. Even though they knew for a fact that the huge pre-dark dish antenna rose above the ville, taller than 100 men and wider than a 20-minute run, they couldn't even see the concrete blockhouse it used as a support base for its massive steel girders and reinforcing struts. 10 men died walking off the cliff near the abandoned stone quarry before Major Sheffield, rather Baron Sheffield, forbade any more patrols outside the wall. The ash storm utterly ruled the Shilohville. Shifting weight from foot to foot, the Sekhmen at the wall endured the raging storm, wishing they were stationed at the front gate. Those lucky bastards were safe inside a brick kiosk with windows and a stove. Probably had a dancing slave and were drinking beer, too. Then one of the guards jerked his head around and took a half step forward.
I just heard that weird noise again.
A private slid his long blaster off his shoulder and clumsily worked the bolt. Advancing to the end of the rope, he tried to see into the howling maelstrom. Ash and dust, nothing else.
It's nothing!
Sergeant Tucholka hunched beside the burnt wreck of a pre-dark tank. Its thick armor was badly warped from the slave revolt. The Titanic wag still offered some degree of protection from the stinging debris.
Yeah, it's just the freaking wind! Told you that already!
The private stared at the hole in the wall.
You sure?
Shut up! I was trying to sleep!
You moron, that's how you got in trouble in the first place.
Tucholka sneered at the man, then realized he couldn't be seen.
Stop it, asshole, that's an order!
The corporal yelled something that he couldn't hear and turned his back on the man. Saying nothing, the privates merely shifted position to keep a closer watch on the vulnerable gap in the ville defenses. Under the iron leadership of Silas Jamevu, the Blues had captured hundreds of people from the surrounding communities, farms, hamlets, and just people passing through Tennessee, forcing the slaves to dig huge stone blocks from the side of a nearby hill and build the Great Wall. The rock was only limestone, not granite, but it took power tools to carve granite and wags to move the massive loads. Nobody sane would give such things to slaves, no matter how well they were chained and watched. The slaves had tried to get free anyway and had been dealt with harshly. Lacking any more workers, the wall remained unfinished with a single 50-foot-wide gap in its expanse, a doorway perfect for Cold Hearts and Mercies, although muties were the real danger these days. The creature seemed to be attracted to the dish for some reason. Maybe it was the soft hum of the transformers, or maybe they could see the microwaves beaming down from space to feed the ville electricity. Nobody knew for sure, and the muties weren't talking. The hole was blocked as best as possible, stuffed solid with barbed wire and electrified with enough current to chill a horse. But armed men still had to stand vigil at the weak point of the perimeter. It was punishment duty, and they knew it. The sarge was guilty of sleeping on duty, the corporal stole shine from the kitchen, and both privates had traded food to slaves for sex. Each of them had been caught in the act, whipped for disobeying orders, reduced in rank, and assigned here as a last chance. One more mistake and they would be put in chains as the first of the new replacement slaves. Wisely, each decided to eat a hand blaster before going into chains. They knew what happened to slaves during the dark and lonely nights.
Death before dishonor.
The private's words were muffled through his heavy mask. The loose ends of his wrappings lashing madly about, the corporal turned.
Huh? What was that?
Something my ma used to say every time she got ganged by the Baron and his sons. Don't know exactly what it means, but she put a lot of stock in it as a curse.
Crap! Ugh. Ugh. Rape is all sluts are good for. That and cooking.
My ma couldn't cook worth shit.
Which is why she got roped so much.